achieve with the MagLoop.
I am not sure what exactly, because I can't draw that picture in my mind, so I'm not quite getting it. In general, you can put capacitive hats on the end of shortened dipoles and having them functionally work like a center-fed dipole. You know, it's not quite the same as a magnetic loop, but in principle, most of the same things are happening.
But I mean, take a, just picture in your mind a regular dipole, but instead of just connecting the coax to the each end of the dipole, you first connect a capacitor, a variable capacitor, and then connect the coax to that, and by varying the capacitor, you achieve what you achieve with a mag loop. What about a loop being a closed structure is different than an open structure, just a dipole with a variable capacitor?
Okay, you would probably need at that configuration more than simply a variable capacitor. What you're talking about really is a is a impedance adjusting, you know, impedance transforming network at the feed point of an antenna, which is certainly possible. The geometry of a straight horizontal shortened dipole is somewhat different than the circular aspect of a magnetic loop, which probably introduces interesting changes into the nodes that are generated and the radiation patterns. But, you know, there are two different ways of resonating slightly different structures. In the case of a magnetic loop, it's effectively having capacitive hats and then twisting them together in a loop. In the other, it's doing the impedance matching at the feed point of a center feed for a shortened dipole.
I've never seen that impedance matching at the center of a dipole. Why not? It just seems like, you know, is the loop concentrating the RF? Is that what's happening? It's concentrating that RF, and the coupling loop is picking up that concentrated RF. And with the dipole, you're not concentrating the RF in one small area. Would that be the difference? And it just seems like if you open up a mag loop and turn it into a dipole with the variable capacitor in the middle, you could almost achieve the same thing. But I've never seen that, and I'm sure you can achieve the same thing. But what's the difference?
It sounded like someone was about to say something, so I'll give them an opportunity. I guess not. It's different depending upon where you're putting things. If you're putting things like capacitive hat at the edges, they work fine like that. If you put the capacitor between the two feed points, it doesn't really work like that. So you can't just put a variable capacitor between the center feed of a shortened dipole and be able to correct. You need a little bit more finesse. But I mean, a lot of people use a version of that to this day. They call it a doublet. It is a non-resonant dipole that is fed through open lines so that the losses are minimal and the impedance matching is done in the shack using an antenna tuner. It's much more convenient than adjusting a tuning network at the feed point for a shortened dipole that theoretically requires more height than a magnetic loop sensor.
And that did lead me to another question: is why, with all other antennas, is height above ground critical, except for a mag loop?
Well, that's not correct. For horizontally oriented antennas, yes. For vertical antennas, no. you've seen vertical antennas planted on the ground. So the point is that although in many ways you could technologically consider a magnetic loop to be a geometrically distorted, shortened dipole, it's not horizontally oriented, and so as long as it's not horizontal, you don't have quite the same problems with reflections and ground coupling. So once again, almost any vertical structure, as long as you have the proper radials to block ground coupling of energy, work perfectly fine, MACFAB on the ground.
I'm sorry, yeah, of course I meant all horizontal antennas. Height above ground is a factor, but not with the magnetic loop. I heard somebody say a magnetic loop should be a loop size, an outer loop size above the ground, but I don't know if he didn't seem to know really what he was talking about. What's the definition of a capacitive hat, Roy? And is that they look like ground planes, don't they? Capacitive hats, if I'm thinking of the same thing.
Yes, they could look like ground planes. They could look like chicken wire. I've seen every configuration. Some of them are squares with diagonals soldered into them, and then the end of the dipole is then soldered to the intersection inside the square. To some people, way back when I first started, some guy brought to one of my clubs a picture of an antenna that had capacitive hats, and I said, "What is that?" And he actually said, "It's a radial upside down," which indicated he didn't know what he was talking about, unfortunately. But yeah, a capacitive hat looks a lot like radials, but they could be, you know, a little bit fancier if the designer so required them to be.
And Roy, how do they function exactly?
They couple to the edges of the antenna and cause the antenna to resonate as though the antenna was longer than it is. They electronically lengthen the length of the antenna, hopefully to the point where it's at a resonant frequency.
Could you substitute an inductive coil for a capacitive hat?
Yes, that would be a loaded coil shortened antenna. You can use a loaded coil at any point on the dipole. You could do it towards the center feed. You could do it in the middle. You could do it at the edge. The reason why you seldom see it at the edge is because it adds a lot more weight at the edge, and it tends to be more mechanically difficult to maintain. But I have seen loaded dipoles with end-mounted coils, and it should work.
Okay. I now have a rotator on my magnetic loop, and it makes about a maximum 3 to 4 dB difference when it's right on compared to when it's off the back of the, so to speak, off the back of the magnetic loop. So because with magnetic loops, you're looking for, every dB is important, it really does make a significant difference. So I'm happy about that. There was one other question I had, but I forget now, and I thank you for your answers.
I said with the magnetic loop? There's always someone. Anyway, getting back, you got to keep in mind a 3 decibel gain or loss is only a half of an S unit. But, sometimes a half S unit makes the difference between understanding or not understanding.
I'm sorry, I was talking S units. 3 to 4 S units different.
Sick of hearing about the magnetic loop.
Okay, that's a lot of directionality. I'm not aware that, there is a degree of directionality in magnetic loops. 3 or 4 S units is 6 times 4 is 24 dB. That's a heck of a, Yankees don't have 24 dB of gain.
Yeah, no, it really does. At least on my radio, I was looking. Maybe 3 S units, not 4, but definitely 3 S units difference.
Okay, again, it's based on standard calibration, that's 18 dB. That's a lot of dB. But, okay, great, wonderful. Enjoy it, have fun with it, talk to a bunch of different people on it, I assume that's kind of the termination of your experimentation, right? Is there anything else you need to test out with this?
One more thing, and that is I would like to swap out the variable capacitor for one with more range and see if I can't get this thing to 40 meters, but I'm sort of done right now. it looks like a robot with the back with the loop as the head, and now it has a rotor on it, and it has a box that contains the battery and the controller card for the motor, and it's getting to look a little bit like a robot. But that's about it, except down the road I will, if I could come by a variable capacitor, that'll give me a lot more range. I'm eager to try that.
Okay, very good. Once again, I wish you luck. I cautioned you before that as you increase the range of your variable capacitor, you are possibly going to get into a situation where the granularity of the servo, the stepper, isn't fine enough to perfectly match all the frequencies that you're interested in. So you might find little gaps if you get too good a capacitor.
Understood. I'm finding that each band needs 3 motor positions. That's what it's come down to. CW portion of the band, and then 2 sideband positions, so you don't have to hunt and peck to get to that lowest SWR. That would be ideal, and I think the guy who made the card is either going to allow people to type in a motor position and then click go, so it'll, you write down the different motor positions on a piece of paper and then click go, and it'll go right to that motor position, or he'll add more memories. Right now he has 10 memories, and I figure it's going to take about 15 memories to cover the 5 bands that this Mag loop covers, 3 positions on each band. So I think that'll do it.
Okay, very good. Rich, as always, thanks for participating. If you remember the question that you forgot, feel free to key in. John, KC2SHO, is in the chat room. Certainly, I would love for you to read something from Dick K2RIW on the subject of resonance.
All right, let me just make sure I have it. From the archives, 2006, Dick Swords are the following. All of the laws known about transmission lines tell us that every antenna, with the exception of super long antennas like rhombic and meter-bridge, which are traveling wave antennas, are standing wave antennas. That means the signal is bouncing back and forth on the antenna lots of times before being efficiently radiated into space. A dipole is definitely one of these types of antennas. At the resonant frequency, that signal bounces back and forth in phase on all the mountains This is one of the definitions of resonance. But when the antenna is in resonance and all the bounces stay co-phased, then the antenna is a simple impedance-matched thing. The antenna radiating system consists of the thing we call an antenna, transmission line, the matchbox, the final pi network, or whatever, of the transmitter, and the transmitter itself. Everything from the final transmitting tube to the actual wire that sends the signal into the air, the total antenna system as a whole, must be able to work well. If you have an antenna tuner that has enough range to it, this is where I paraphrase, just about any piece of wire can be a suitable antenna. Again, if you have enough range. So, you know, it sounds like what he was asking about earlier is just putting the tuner right on the antenna instead of down the transmission line. AC2GS from PC2M.
Well, yes, John. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to work this. If you use a very low-loss transmission line like open wire, you can use a doublet, and you could have the impedance transforming circuits in your shack, and because there's very little loss, you can get away with it. In other cases, if you really don't like open line, because it has some issues, you can place a antenna tuner at the feed point remotely and have it do the transformation of the impedance. Or theoretically, you could do it someplace in the radiating antenna. There are probably 6 or 7 dozen different ways of explaining a lot of really fundamental things. With standing wave antennas, which are most of the antennas that we amateurs use regularly, the reason why there is no phase shift when it reflects back and forth is because there is no reactance. If there was a capacitive reactance or an inductive reactance, every reflection would be ever so slightly out of phase with each other, and so you wouldn't have a stable standing wave. So, like I said, there must be dozens and dozens of different ways to just as legitimately explain what resonance is and isn't.
Here's just a tiny bit more, and I'll leave it back to you. Energy launched into the antenna bounces back and forth something like 30 times, with the correct length those bounces are in your face. It does not look like a resistor. Make the antenna a little too long, and the bounces will become lagging in phase, more inductive. Make the antenna a little too short, and the bounces will begin leading in phase, so capacitive. All bounces are in phase. I think this is the important key. When somebody's trying to understand what they're doing when they're matching, if those bounces aren't in phase, it is destructive to the radiation of the antenna.
Yeah, I guess. I totally agree. It's the whole concept of resonance. The reason why resonant things are so important is because they're an efficient means of storing energy. When you have something in a resonant structure, it adds up and stores the energy. That's why, unfortunately, when people poorly design a bridge so that footsteps produce a resonant frequency instead of dissipating with negative interference, it all adds up and adds up and adds up and gets stored and stored until it's at the mechanical breaking point of the bridge and the bridge collapses. So standing waves require resonance in the oscillating RF. Again, you can discuss it in terms of reactance or just length versus what other reactance does. So, six to one, half a dozen the other. But I agree totally with what Dick said. A long time ago, we had a weird discussion. He used to like to go on about infinitesimal dipoles. And I used to bring up radiation resistance. And the problem is that although theoretically, you should be able to get by with an infinitesimal antenna. Because the infinitesimal antenna introduces an infinitesimal radiation resistance, you get stuck with the same problem of insertion losses unless you have antenna tuners and transmission lines that were designed by the Jet Propulsion Lab, you're going to have a great deal of inefficiency due to inertia loss. But on a theoretical basis, as far as the equations are concerned, your aperture remains the same, your gain remains the same, just your radiation resistance goes into the garbage can.
You're real good, Roy. I got to get on to making dinner here, but I just thought those comments were related to what was trying to be explained earlier, and I hope they would be helpful to the other gentlemen in the understanding of what's actually happening. You know, so if you're leading or lagging in space, you got to add or remove capacitance or inductors. And some people do that directly on the antenna. That's why you see some of these antennas with very interesting design concepts. They're just working on correcting that lagging or leading phase issue to bring it back into resonance so that those ounces will be in co-phase. Real good. I appreciate the opportunity to have that EC2GS.
You're welcome, John. I'm sure people benefited. I like to always to hear quotes from Dick. And another thing that I like to point out to people, because occasionally everyone sort of forgets this, or a lot of people forget this, is that there's nothing really special about a total impedance of a circuit. A center-fed dipole in free space has an impedance of 73 ohms. When you take it close to the ground, it couples a bit. It goes down to about 50 ohms. Yagis usually don't have an impedance of 50 ohms. This is why usually they employ things like gamma matches. So resonance is not quite the same as standing wave ratio. You can have a resonant antenna whose impedance is something other than 50 ohms. So the two are separate, which is why a lot of resonant antennas then employ an impedance-matching circuit like a gamma or a delta match.
Well, it reminds me of the difficulties I have whenever I'm trying to tune a Ringo Ranger.
Antenna design's fascinating. I caution people without a postgraduate degree to probably not read too heavily a college-level antenna theory book, because the matrix math can give you a nosebleed, but there are a lot of wonderful publications out there on antennas and antenna design. Of course, there's the ARRL. There's the Royal Radio Society of Great Britain has a handbook on antennas design, and there's this German translated antenna book by someplace called Rockhammel to look at. And they're all very good, very fascinating, and you know, you could spend a couple of lives trying to figure out how all these antennas work. It still gives me a headache trying to figure out the different modes that something like a G5RB requires to use in order to have resonance at different bands.
Roy, Rich, I have another question.
Okay, Rich.
Never used it, but are you familiar with reverse beacon and how it works?
Not a great deal. A beacon is usually a station set up someplace where people report reception and log into websites usually, and you can go to the website and see what frequency a beacon is being received. The reverse beacon would be in the opposite direction where I would assume you're sending the beacon. And other people are either automatically or manually reporting reception.
Yeah, I think you call CQ, and I think you do this on CW, and then there are stations around that around the world that if they hear your CQ, they report it. Or something, I'm not quite sure, but I was talking
last night to someone who uses it, and I forgot to ask him exactly how do you use it. There is a Reverse Beacon website, but I couldn't quite understand how it worked. I wonder if anybody else out there has used Reverse Beacon to see who could hear them.
Okay, Rich. He might have been alluding to something called WhisperNet, which is another product of Joe Taylor, who everyone uses FT8 and a bunch of other things that Joe has worked on. So WhisperNet, as far as I'm aware, is kind of automated. You run a program, if it controls your transmitter, it'll transmit a binary signal, and then you go to the website. And there are receivers that have Joe's software in it as well, and they listen on frequencies, and when they find it, they report it to the website, and you see the map light up with your call sign.
WB2BXO with a comment?
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe WhisperNet and RBN.org are two different things. And I think the description I think you gave before, I haven't actually tried it, but the way I understand it is you can send CQ or CQDX and then look on RBN.org and see who around the world is receiving your signal. And it seems like quite a good way to see how your station is really doing. As opposed to making contacts to check out an antenna and that sort of thing. So that's how I understand it, it works. And the stations receiving you are generally, what the heck do they call them? Things like W3LTL, the CW skimmers, that's the term. I think generally you get the CW skimmers, the automated skimmers around the world that are receiving it. So that's my understanding of how RBN.org works. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, Frank. I mean, there are different things. The Reverse Beacon Network is one thing, and Whisper, WSPR, is a slightly different thing, but I think they ultimately serve the same purpose. I think Reverse Beacon is more of a manual design, I think Whisper is again some aspect of Joe Taylor's software. His same software that lets you run FT8 and such, I think, lets you either send or receive Whisper transmissions, and then if you're receiving them, logging on to a website.
But more with the Reverse Beacon, how do they single out your signal? You know what I mean? Of all the signals traversing the globe, when you send CQDX, W2BZ, how do they know it's a signal that they need to report back on?
Is there any identifier, and is there any frequency that's recommended for these transmissions? I would assume there is.
No, I couldn't find a frequency at all. I just know that that you can't do it on sideband. You just can't call CQ. So I guess they're decoding your call. And I don't know, it's very confusing to me how these skimmers or whatever they're called, how they single out your transmission out of all the transmissions that can be heard and draw a map and a connecting line between where you are and where they are. It's just sort of confusing to me. But it's probably not... It's probably fairly simple.
Yeah, again, I would assume that there is some specific frequency that's used for a Reverse Beacon. If anyone is familiar with how it works, please feel free.
As far as I can tell, they're scanning the whole CW band and picking out everybody's call sign that they receive. If you look at the DX spotting clusters, you're going to see an incredible number of spots from the CW skimmers, from W3LTL in the United States, and depending on what you're filtering for from around the from other locations around the world. So, no, they do not look at specific frequencies the way PSK-31 does or FT-8, which is pretty much centered around a specific frequency, or Whisper for that matter. That's my understanding of it without really having played with it yet.
Doc, I don't know the details. Of course, John KD2BD has a couple of links in the chat room. Again, you can get to the chat room by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. He has the main webpage, and he says you need to send a CQ or a test DE your call sign to get spotted. And he has a page of how to get spotted. I'm curious, you know, how much of this is automated and how much of this is manual. There are CW sweepers out there. I've used them before. If you have a steady hand or you use a gear, it's not difficult for a computer to decode your call sign and such. Once it's able to do that, the rest is extremely easy. So, again, they sort of serve the same purpose, although apparently one is kind of loosier, goosier, and the other one is a much more structured, and you got to kind of download Joe Taylor's software, use it, and go back to the website. Oh, by the way, John says it's fully automated, so that's good. So that's, you know, I guess it has very good CW reading software. Also, he says it does PSK and RIDI signals.
So you go on this website, you send a CQ, DX, or just a CQ in Morse code, and all of a sudden on the map, your signal is being reported back on by multiple skimmers. That seems too good to be true, but I'll investigate it more. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. And tell us, come back and tell us what you found. Okay, once again, I remain AC2GS, and I remain Roy, and this remains the Limar Technical Net. So if you're out there and you have a question or a topic for discussion, want to tell me about something that you brought up on the Technical Net some time ago and you found some resolution that we are unaware of, all of the above, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign.
Yeah, one more comment on the skimmers, Roy, WB2BX.
Yeah, sure, Frank.
At one evening, probably a month or two ago, I remember seeing some interesting DX call signs being spotted on odd frequencies, like 1804, or way below the DX window, and at times of day when I didn't think it was dark in those DX locations. So I clicked on the spots and found that what was happening was the W1AW was sending the DX bulletin on 1804, I think it was, and the skimmers were picking up the DX call signs and reporting them. The automation can do some strange things sometimes. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Automation occasionally screws up, so, you know, at least for now. You know, what happens in 10, 15, 20 years with artificial intelligence, I do not know, but yeah. It's probably not that difficult to confuse relatively simply written script software. Well, once again, this continues to be AC2GS, and we're here at the Limar Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push-to-talk button. All WB2IKT with a question that came up on a conversation on the air this week.
Certainly.
Okay, talking with a number of people, the question was raised about velocity factors on coaxial cable. The specific question was, have a cable, coax, with a velocity factor of 0.66, and you attach that coax directly to a different piece of coax, same in feet, but a velocity factor of 0.86. What does it take to accelerate the signal in the cable that has the higher velocity factor?
Well, I mean, as far as I can consider it, you're pretty much asking the same question as what happens when light goes into a glass of water. When it gets out the other end, what causes it to speed up? Since the idea of the velocity of things at the speed of light, not in a vacuum, are a little hairy. It's not actual, it's the apparent speed, it's not the actual speed, it has to do with interaction with the dielectric medium in the case of coaxial cable. So as soon as the RF goes past the coax cable with a velocity factor at 66 into, say, something with a velocity factor of 92, it just the effective velocity speeds up instantaneously at the interface.
Okay, thank you. My response was that the velocity changes, but then so does the wavelength. And my take on it is that the wavelength gets somewhat longer as it goes slower. So if wavelength is going faster, the wavelength will increase a little bit. And that is the prime difference. Not the wavelength at free space, but rather the wavelength on each individual coax section.
Well, yeah, because they're interrelated. As you decrease the speed of the signal, the effective wavelength shortens. As you increase it, it lessens. So they're interrelated. The velocity factor is directly proportional to the wavelength of any given frequency.
Right, right. And I understand that, but it seems to be unfortunate that velocity factor is given as the speed of something like, say, a car, and all of a sudden there's no room for it. There's no acceleration ramp room, I guess you'd call it, for the signal to suddenly start increasing speed. And as in the case of an automobile, it takes additional energy to make it go faster. That seems to confuse a lot of people.
Well, yeah, because unfortunately it gets very weird when you start to talk about electromagnetic waves. The way most people perceive it, that it's going at a different velocity in different mediums, would suggest a violation of the conservation of energy. You know, if it speeds up when it leaves that glass of water, what's providing the extra energy for it speeding up? It's again because the difference between apparent velocity and actual velocity is very difficult to wrap your mind around.
Yeah.
Joanne?
Understood. I was trying to look for an easy way to explain it. Somewhat technical, but certainly not electrical engineering and Maxwell's wave equations of savvy people. That would have been a bit above them. So I was looking for a sort of an easy way to explain it. And the best thing I could come up with was that it's the wavelength that changes. And it's an unsatisfactory explanation for a lot of people.
Well, by the way, Paul recognized it at the end second. To me, my problem way back before I kind of knew how electromagnetism tends to work is is you kind of answering it with a definition of you know, what does wavelength mean? It doesn't really, as far as I could see, ultimately answer the question as much as it just defines how velocity factor changes the effective wavelength of propagating waves. But, you know, it's not an easy thing to answer. You know, there are some things that you can simplify so that everyone understands them, and then there are other things that if you simplify it enough that everyone understands it, you've simplified it into gobbledygook that doesn't really answer the question ultimately. So, I mean, I spend an inordinate amount of time trying to figure out simpler analogies for complicated things that don't lose a lot of the reality of the topic. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I like his car analogy. You know, to me, you know, you could be riding down a highway and you're pushing on the gas and you have a certain amount of energy, you know, a certain amount of horsepower behind that car, and then you hit this real muddy area for about, you know, a mile. But you still haven't taken your foot off the gas. You're still on it, but you know that muddy area is just slowing you down. Now you get through that muddy area, your energy is still there. You pop out on the other side, and now you take off. Now you're going 60 miles an hour again. But that's what I thought about. When he brought up the car analogy. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's a reasonable one, but my response probably back in the old days would be, well, your engine is still running, so you keep on burning gasoline. Where's the gasoline in a beam of light going through a glass of water? You know, it doesn't have to be connected to the source anymore. It could just be a propagating beam of light going through that glass of water. It reaches the glass. It effectively seems to slow down. It then reaches the water, it speeds up a little, and then it goes to the other side of the glass where it slows down a little, and then it speeds up a lot. You know, where does that velocity change occur? Where is the energy source? Is conservation of energy being violated or not under those circumstances?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you have a radio wave that's moving along at a certain speed, and then you come across this basically resistance axis. Now you change to the other coaxis, the faster coaxis. The same energy is there. It just slowed that down, and maybe it changed its amplitude a little bit, or maybe it changed the like you said, the frequency. So you pop out on the other side, maybe that all reverses again. You know, the energy is still there. So that's maybe why it starts going at, you know, at a faster speed. But I don't know. I like the car analogy. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I understand. Like I said, there are a lot of analogies out there. Some are better than others. Again, my problem would tend to be with the conservation of energy, because these are ultimately, you can say that there's a source for it at all times, but not really. It, you know, you can turn off the transmitter, and for an instantaneous, you know, fraction of a second, there's still propagation of your signal going up the transmission line and into your antenna and radiating back and forth the standing wave. So, you know, there's a question of where does it receive the extra energy to speed up when it goes from one dielectric with a slower velocity factor than the next place is always, which strikes me as always a problem. But, you know, I'm just saying personally. Anyway, George, thanks for the question. It brought up a lot of information and topics, and I don't know the simplest way of explaining it. You know, you can get buried in the woods between velocity and phase velocity and other aspects of the way that waves work. Some velocities impart information, and other types of wave velocities don't impart information. You can have a wave that travels faster than the speed of light in a vacuum as long as it's a wave that doesn't carry information. It's the transport of information that's limited by space-time. But again, that gets into very esoteric, weird places, so it's not a simplification, unfortunately.
Okay, Roy, thanks. Book I'm using as a reference. It may help some other folks around. It's a relatively new ARRL book called Antenna Physics. Really, it gives some very good explanations, but you sort of really have to dig into them. They definitely aren't simplified. And the nice thing about this book is it actually walks you through Maxwell's equations and tells you what they mean and how to use them.
Yeah, I got that book, too, on my shelf. Maxwell's Equations. Oh, gosh. There's a lot of books on Maxwell's Equations. There are different forms of Maxwell's Equations. There are differential versions. There are integral versions. There are relativistically written versions to do relativistic radio theory, electrodynamics. There are quantum versions for quantum electrodynamic theory. So, yeah, I have a couple of T-shirts that I usually wear at Hamfest that have his Maxwell's Equations written on them.
Yeah, I'm assuming that you mean the one that North put together that actually brings the 20 equations that Maxwell had down to four. Field, the H field, and you can tell what the other two are.
Yeah, the original ones probably wouldn't fit well on a T-shirt. So the standard, whenever you see them, occasionally they're the differential versions, occasionally they're the integral versions. But yeah, they're four equations: Ampere's law, Maxwell's equation, Ampere's equation, and then I block on the other two guys.
Yeah, Faraday's law of induction, and Maxwell's force, which is the displacement current.
Yeah, it's all good stuff, and he discovered and documented it in the 18th century. Clever man. But it's nice that it cleaned up to four somewhat simpler equations, and the relativistic version, I think, is a little bit more complicated, unfortunately, but what can you do? But, there's a lot of good stuff out there. A lot of it is in the public domain. You could Google Richard Feynman did a bunch of courses which included a lot of electrical physics type of discussions. They're available on the web.
Yeah, I guess one of my regrets is that I had to work real hard at calculus to get it. Maxwell's equations, per se, I don't want to say they elude me, but they really come close. I could probably use a good tutor on that.
I am sure that there are loads and loads and loads of YouTube where I know, we talked, I think, last week about that physics professor from MIT who's retired now, who, again, I'm blocking, unfortunately, his name, but John, if he isn't out cooking, will probably remind me of it. I'm sure there's loads of YouTube versions of going into detail of Maxwell's theory. I would suggest personally my own. I stay away from the Indian electrical engineers just because a lot of them really have thick accents that make it even more difficult to understand the underlying subject. But I'm sure there's a lot of material. I mean, if you don't like the derivation of Maxwell's theory, you can imagine what Schrodinger's equation is to describe electron orbitals. I took a course of that in college many, many years ago.
Yeah, I looked at Schrodinger's equation briefly, and I decided I would be best sticking with Maxwell.
or at least I vaguely understood what he was talking about. Yes, that's a very wise decision, although Schrodinger's equation is an actual wave equation. So it's vaguely related to electromagnetism, because electromagnetism is a wave phenomena as well. But yeah, you'll gain a lot more with Maxwell's equations than you will by being able to derive what the probability field for electron orbitals are. There's very little practical layman's use for that information.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. That's been helpful. Again, what I was actually seeking was how does that relatively advanced concept help the folks that might not quite understand it.
Yeah, I understand. Like I said, I spend way too much time trying to pick up analogies that I like. Occasionally, I will bump into analogies that I hate. Stephen Hawking was a brilliant man, and he discovered something called Hawking radiation, which is somewhat very similar to the way that black bodies emit thermal energy. But black holes do it on the event horizon. The reason that he discovered it was a brilliant labor of love, where he got into something very hairy called quantum gravity, which is very poorly understood. But because it's so poorly understood that when he wrote the popular books, he decided that people would be bored or confused, so he made up a reason for his Hawking radiation that was complete nonsense that annoyed physicists endlessly. But you know, there are millions of copies of Stephen Hawking's popular book, and each and every one of them contains basically a technical lie of it trying to falsely explain a principle that I think he just didn't trust people who bought his book to understand, so he decided not to even entertain it. And, you know, I think that's a shame. I think he probably should have tried a little harder.
Good to know. Thank you. This is WB Bright. Thank you.
You're welcome, George. Pleasure. Once again, I am Roy, AC2GS. This is the Limar Technical Net. We do have a few more minutes left, so if anyone out there has any other topics or questions or comments, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
Yeah, comments on the book, Roy?
Yeah, sure, Frank.
Yeah, I think I did read the book a long time ago, but I don't remember that section in any really at all. But in any case, it's also possible that you know, an editor tried to simplify what he was saying. So his books, as you know, go through many layers of editing, and in the end, it has to go out the door. And it's possible either he missed the fact the way that he's rewritten didn't work, or just decided to heck with it. It's that deadline; it has to go out.
Well, I mean, I never really read the lore or the history of the book. I would doubt that an editor would suggest a BS explanation. Most literary editors don't really have the foundation in physics. They tended to be English majors and such. I could easily see the case where an editor said, Stephen, this explanation, I don't understand it at all. Can you change it to something I can understand? And then Stephen Hawking not giving a damn and making up. You know, he made up a really ridiculous idea. He said that basically Hawking radiation, every so often matter and antimatter pairs pop into existence. And so at the event horizon, a matter and antimatter pair pop into existence. One is closer to the event horizon and fall into the black hole. The other one shoots out and produces energy. And when the one that was suddenly turned into being goes into the black hole, it eats up some of the black hole and decreases its mass. Problem being that that's not really how virtual particles really work. It's probably not even a thing, vertical particles. It has much more to do with probability of wave equations and such. But even if you had an anti-electron or an anti-piece of matter going into a black hole, antimatter has a positive mass. Nothing has a negative mass. So nothing could have fallen into the black hole that would have decreased the mass. So that was, you know, a first level of, you know, a first term physics college student would know that there's something really off with that reasoning. So I most of the people who read it didn't care, most likely. I happen to have cared, but I'm a strange person.
Interesting, Nick.
Yes, Wesley, do you have a comment, or you want to ask a question after we're done with this?
After we're done with it.
Okay, very good. So, Frank, back to you. I think this is something Stephen Hawking. He was a very brilliant man, but he really needed the money, I think, and he made a ridiculous amount of money. He republished pretty much the same book at least five times that I was counting.
Sounds like the way I essentially rewrite the same content in my blog, whatever kind of ideas a lot of us do. Anyway, okay, I guess it's time to move on. And Wesley, please know that the calculus or whatever it is that none of us understand.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Wesley, what's your topic for tonight?
The two of them are short. I wasn't before on the TechNet, so you might have talked about it, but I have no idea if you did. One was artificial intelligence kill the operator. That's, of course, in parentheses. And the second one was the ID of the squelch. So let's start with the first one. Did you see the video?
I didn't see the video, but we discussed that report, and it was mistaken, and someone mentioned that it might have been a simulation that got explained incorrectly. So we did cover that one.
Okay, the second one was the short video that I have sent you, which allows any one of you guys listening to or talking, including me, to be identified. Fingerprint. Did you see that video?
AC2GS. Yes, I saw the video. It's not quite as much a print on the user, but a print on the transmitter. The general tendencies when it starts transmission, if it has any sidebars, if it takes a little while for the oscillator to lock into the proper frequency. My problem would be, if interesting, the demonstration, I would be curious if you tested it with, say, 100 or 200 or 300 transmitters and saw considerable significant differences in all of them, or whether his demonstration was a particularly wonky transmitter.
My understanding is that if we have preliminary identification for a signal based on its squelch property, transmitting property, or beginning of the transmitting property, everybody has to press the microphone. Then any time that station presses the button on the microphone, that is a part of that allows you an ID of a transmitter, including all of the people hosting the job. Now, we have hundreds of them. There is a situation where two people press the button exactly the same time, or similar time apart, but then they didn't do it in purpose, it's just they did it and then with a factor of probability. So, sooner or later,
they're going to be identified by their own call sign, either voluntarily or given because it's a rule to give it. And then that could be also memory. Now, as when we're talking about some stations who want to interfere with the traffic of America operators, without giving any call sign, they could be actually memorized, and then anytime they click the button, it could be identified as that intervening station.